Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Okay, welcome back, everybody. I'm your co-host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by another co-host at Building the Sales Machine, but he's also the head of inside sales at ZocDoc. I'd like to introduce Evan Bartlett. Say hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on the show, man. We had a couple of really interesting conversations leading up to this. And I think this is going to be a slightly higher level conversation than most of our previous episodes. Because normally we get into sort of the detailed tactics of, you know, individual prospecting efforts or, you know, how to write an email, when GIFs are great to use, when videos are great to use. But today we're going to kind of step it a level up. Because Evan's in a bit of a unique situation in that he's one of the guests on the show that's probably built fairly large, one of the largest teams that we've had so far. How many people would sort of roll up underneath you here?
So today we have about 80 sellers and managers on the inside sales team. And then in prior roles at Living Social, we had teams that were quite a bit larger than that.
Mm-hmm. And so the topic today is really focused on sort of sales management and how it's the key to sort of leveraging and scaling your sales organization. So
absolutely.
Evan, I'd love to sort of start with, like, can you give me an overview of, like, what are some of the key components to scaling a sales org?
Yeah. So I think this is a big topic for startups and startup sales leaders. Everyone wants to know how to scale or is thinking about scaling or is about to scale. And so I think a couple of the big categories that I think about, or that I think about now that I've been on a very large sales team, and these are categories that might be underrepresented for people who are doing it for the first time, are really the systems required for that scaling. So typically software, Salesforce, add-on tools like Cadence tools, lead enrichment tools, lead scoring tools, leadership capacity, because they're largely, you know, having those frontline conversations for the company every day with sellers, training, investing in either sales training, sales enablement, onboarding training, and hopefully upskilling after they're already on the team. And then the kind of the sales operations and analytics engine of the sales team. These days, I don't think you can do anything without measuring it. And most salespeople and most sales managers aren't as comfortable doing that or don't necessarily have the time to do it. So thinking about what sales operations is going to carry for you.
No, we could probably spend an episode, you know, on each of those and probably multiple episodes on each one. So where do you think is the most important place to start?
So I think the most important and often the most overlooked is the leadership and the sales management component of that. So few sales teams even can pull together training for their sellers, right? They might get 1 week of new hire training, maybe they get 2 weeks and then a touch base a month or two later, and that's it, right? They don't see much else from the individual contributor perspective. And then almost none of these sales organizations provide any kind of training for sales managers. So I think it's overlooked consistently by everyone. I know HBR recently published an article. I think the title was "No One Really Explains What Leadership Is." So it's this vague term everyone throws around, but no one knows kind of tactically what am I doing? What am I doing day to day? What is my actual job? There's a million things I could be doing, and so I think because of these reasons, it's overlooked, and it's your single biggest point of leverage because they're the ones having one-on-one conversations every single day with the most important people at your company, which is your salespeople. And they're the ones that can influence salespeople and their selling styles and their behaviors day to day and their process. And, you know, no single leader can do that, can have one-on-ones with every single seller. Once you get past, you know, I've heard 18 to 20 thrown around as the number that, you know, a senior sales leader starts to break.
18 to 20.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality, if you think about how experience is passed on from team member to team member, it's, mm-hmm. it's through one-on-one time between an experienced team member and an inexperienced one. That can be a sales leader, that can be other sellers, And if you only have a few sellers and one or two sales managers and you bring in 30 new hires, you're going to outstrip that experience to inexperience ratio.
I couldn't imagine having an 18-to-1 sales manager to sales rep. I mean,
it was just a friend of mine who was a VP of sales and didn't get his first sales manager till 20. Part of it was the CEO of the company didn't think it was necessary. Part of it was he couldn't find one, but I can't imagine employees 16, 17, 18, and 19 getting the training and the attention and the onboarding that they might need that maybe employees two, salespeople 2, 3, 4, and 5 might have received.
I mean, everybody on the show can do some basic math here. If you've got 20 people rolling up to you and you decide to work a 60-hour week, you can still maximum only spend 3 hours with everybody. And that's assuming you're not doing anything else. So yeah. that's a little bit tough to manage, I'd say.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, it's underserviced. It's not well understood. There's no training, and it is the direct conduit between the company and its sellers, especially once you get past 20. Mm-hmm. And I think for all of these reasons, it's a huge point of leverage.
So maybe just to give everybody some context, you've got 80 people on your team. I'm assuming they all don't roll up to you. Can you walk us through what that structure looks like?
Yep. So you know, I can talk through this hierarchy, or I can talk to kind of some of the hierarchies I've seen somewhere else, but typically I think the right ratio is somewhere between 6 and 10 team members. Keeping in mind that the less experienced the team members, the lower the ratio. I see a lot of companies with their brand new SDRs doing 18, 19, 20 to a team. And I think it's the opposite, right? 6 SDRs to a team. When you have super experienced team members that no longer have any questions, you can get away with 8 or 10 or maybe even 12 if you need to, because they're less needy, they're less dependent on the manager. So we have that kind of 6-to-8 ratio in mind, reporting up to a manager. Managers will report up to a senior manager. I think a lot of other companies call these directors. Mm-hmm. And then our senior managers roll up to the director, and the director rolls up to me. So I think, you know, 6-to-8 is the ratio to look for on the frontline management. When people move into the world of managing managers, I think the ratio is probably 2 managers max, maybe 3, especially when you're getting into that first leading leader's experience. The same thing happens, right? If you take on 5, you're going to do a really bad job at coaching and supporting all 5 of those team members. So I think you start with 2, and then you can add sales managers from there as the team needs to grow.
Gotcha. It seems like I'm sure every, you know, CEO that's sitting on here that's trying to do the org mapping is like, wait, one director for 2 managers? That's, what are you people doing all day?
Yeah, no, I think that's the way things go in terms of the natural order, where CEOs can't possibly imagine that you would need so many. And then it's the same thing when it comes to thinking about, you know, marketing, there's kind of always this conflict in how they see things. And I think the way to think about it is the sales manager or the sales leader is responsible primarily for the development of their people, which is the thing that gets cannibalized the quickest in a sales leader's time. All this other stuff that pops up, forecasting, which doesn't generate revenue, right? It's just predicting what might happen. And, you know, things like that come at the cost of the work that actually generates the revenue, which is sitting with your team members, coaching them through calls, identifying where they have gaps in their skill set that are causing them to convert at a lower rate, and then going out and fixing the problem, which might take, you know, hours and hours and hours of headsetting just to get there, because these things don't happen. You know, mm-hmm. pitches don't happen 100 times a day. And so I think that work gets left behind. And so you get forecasting, one-on-ones, team meetings, company-wide meetings, executive meetings, and everything except for the things that drive revenue happen. And I think one way to preserve that is span of control. Another way to control that is, you know, put a limit on meetings and just, you know, temper your expectations for leadership outside of just selling. Managing is a full-time job. Mm-hmm. Just that should take up most of their time.
And I think that's a huge sort of mental shift, because I don't know a lot of individuals that think of managing people as a revenue generating activity.
Yep. Absolutely. So I think, you know, why do I think that might be the right question? You know, there's a good book called The Accidental Sales Manager, where they talk a lot about your first step into leadership. And I think he likes to bring up the sales management trap, right? Which is to get caught firefighting, to get caught kind of fixing any and all problems rather than focusing on the core problem. And the way I've seen that sales management trap manifest itself, especially with new frontline managers, is that they are firefighting and often getting involved in closing the deals themselves so much that they're actually not teaching their sellers or team members to do that work. And so what they do is they create a dependency rather than develop an individual that can stand on their own and hit their target. You know, in some organizations, I think it's probably much easier said than done, because the target might be easy enough to hit and the sales manager might be kind of like a super AE and their team members setting meetings for them. And so I think, you know, this obviously depends, and this is kind of the caveat for everything we say, it really totally depends on industry, product, ACV, all of that. Some of the things I'm saying might be the right thing for your business. But generally speaking, you're not going to get the revenue production if it's one person closing everything that you could get if that person can develop and build 8 full-fledged experienced sellers that don't need day-to-day oversight. The second one takes a little bit more time, and that's often why it gets sacrificed for short-term results. And that's kind of the vicious sales management trap cycle that people fall into.
So now that like, I think everybody's sort of on board with, yes, this is a very high leverage activity that we need to make sure we carve out time for. What does good sales management look like?
So, you know, I've been a practitioner of bad sales management and good sales management over the years. So obviously a lot of this was kind of created from my personal experiences. And then when I moved into the position where I was developing sales managers, and they were asking, you know, what the heck is this? How do we define it? And so I really looked at my shortcomings and I said, you know, what problems am I facing on the team? And I would write those down. I'd be like, as the sales manager, I need to be able to deliver these things. And so it fell into a handful of categories. I look for people who can create buy-in. So that is kind of earn the trust and credibility of their team members. There are positive and negative ways to do that. But ultimately, if you're going to lead, you have to earn that right. It doesn't just kind of come with the title. They need to be strong, effective communicators, because ultimately they're in a position of communicating the job to their team members. They need to be strong motivators. And I think that starts with understanding that every single seller has different individual motivations for being there. And so that requires some flexibility when, you know, coaching or leading different teams. I think a lot of people default to just assuming that everyone's motivated by the same things that they are motivated by. And then, you know, now we get to the big one, right, which is development, which is, you know, coaching, giving feedback, and teaching someone to sell in the same way or at the same level that you were when you were an individual contributor. The last couple, this next one is accountability. I keep that kind of later in the pile, because I think if you haven't done the traits or the tasks up above, you probably haven't earned the right to hold sales reps accountable. Mm-hmm. But there are times where you have to have those tough conversations where you as the leader put in a lot of time, really worked to help get this person to this point, and maybe they didn't honor their side of the equation, and you got to have that tough conversation. And then the last two, I think, our structure, right? You have to be a little bit more organized as a sales manager. I've seen lots of top reps get by with messy pipelines, no task management. But if you're a manager and you're managing the pipelines of 7, 8, 9 reps, you got to be more organized. You got to be thinking about this in a structured way. The old world of just kind of winging it every time starts to really fall apart there. And then the last part is you got to understand and be more analytical. A lot of salespeople are driven by instinct and emotion and feelings. And when you move into the world of management, you're going to be spending a lot more time looking at those numbers. And in my experience, those numbers don't always tell you what your instincts tell you. And at some point when they are in contradiction, it's okay to challenge them and confirm that the numbers are right. But at some point, those numbers might be right and they're telling you something different, and you're going to have to go against your gut feel and you're going to have to change your behavior based on that. Mm-hmm. Not all salespeople have that ability, but I think once you move into the sales management world, there comes a time where you have to be able to do that and side with the numbers. After that, if you can build the numbers, track them, run the analysis yourself, that's kind of icing on the cake. Hopefully you have a sales ops team to do some of that for you.
Hopefully if you're scaling up. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Right. I think many of these things are things that managers could spend, you know, way too much time doing if there isn't a separate sales operations team handling this work for you. Frankly, that's the premise for me of having a sales operations team, is to help keep your sellers focused on selling.
So I love it. If the sales ops team is there to help the sellers keep focused on selling, whose job is it to keep the managers focused on managing? And I guess maybe before we jump into that, like as a manager, how do I make sure I'm checking all of these boxes on a daily basis? Do you have post-it notes that you sort of write it down on? Have you got this like tattooed on the inside of your arm? Because like, that's a lot to juggle.
I think if we knew the answer to that, we'd have a kind of a multi-billion dollar sales training and sales management coaching company. So the first question, who helps the managers focus on managing? I think it's the primary responsibility of their manager. So the sales director or senior sales manager, depending on how the organization is structured. I think it also falls on sales ops, right? Having kind of defining those roles up front and understanding which responsibilities fall on which teams. And I think a really healthy relationship between the three is sales ops, when undertaking a new project, might do some discovery work up front with the sales manager, might do some shadowing on the team, gathering their input, making sure that they kind of understand the day-to-day, because after all, the manager and the salespeople are the experts on that. Mm-hmm. And then they might go away, do the analysis, and then come back and present something back to the sales manager. I think that's a really healthy relationship. If you don't have those resources, I end up seeing some kind of analytically inclined sales managers just doing it all. Right, you have that hero sales manager that's recruiting, doing the onboarding training themselves, writing Salesforce reports, doing the forecasting for the CEO. It never works out that the sales reps win in that equation. And so I think the senior leaders need to be protecting people and asking themselves, am I asking too much of my sales managers? Mm-hmm.
And so the follow-up question, as an individual sales manager, how do we keep track of all this?
You know, so I think let's be honest, right? Not every sales manager is going to do all of these things in spades. I think there is a kind of minimum bar that you need to be able to hit in these equations. And then they're going to be your natural strengths, right? I know people that are just incredible motivators, but they're not as analytical. Right, I know people that are off the charts analytical, but they really struggle to connect with their team members. And so I think if that equation gets too far out of balance, I think the whole thing falls apart, and you're going to have a manager that can't effectively lead. And the question is, how do you get that minimum level? And so I think being aware of them up front and then setting these expectations, I think the senior leader that's working and developing that manager, if you start with this equation on the table, as they get going, the both of you can be making an assessment. Like, where are your strengths? Where are your weaknesses? Where are some blind spots? Some things that could be helping you get the buy-in of your team and lead them in the right direction, but maybe we've underinvested in. So I don't know if that answers the question, but it's a constant juggling act. This list came from me personally as a leader, always feeling like I was dropping one of the balls that I was juggling and failing out of this guilt, being like, I need to build a list, right? I need to write this stuff down so that I'm constantly checking in and saying, like, am I at the top of my game for any one of these categories? And I know some of these categories I'm terrible in, right? And motivation is a really tough one for me because I'm hyper motivated. I'm always thinking about sales 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And we have salespeople that don't, right? We have salespeople that want to go back to their homes and see their families and not think about sales. And so it was a long, hard lesson for me to kind of be open to that and to accept that and learn to relate and speak to that kind of seller. And I've had great sellers that have that profile and have just delivered incredible value to the organization. And I would have been missing out on that if I didn't learn to connect with them.
Awesome. So I'd love to sort of dive in on some of these traits. There's buy-in, communication, motivation, development, accountability, structure, process, and analytics. Mm-hmm. So you say basically they all build on each other, sort of like a pyramid. And if you remove one of these layers, basically, so buy-in is at the top of my list, but I guess at the bottom of the pyramid, if you lose buy-in, then everything else falls apart.
So I think, you know, let's take this from the perspective of either a new manager that got promoted internally or a new manager coming in from outside of the organization. Right away, first step for both is how do I earn the trust and get the buy-in of the new team members that I'm going to be leading? Mm-hmm. The external manager has an uphill battle, right? Immediately the sellers are thinking, you don't know my product, you haven't sold this. None of the sales skills you've developed over your career could possibly be relevant in our situation. And the internal person, if they were the top salesperson, regardless of whether or not it's true, everyone's saying, well, you know how to get results and you're going to be able to teach me how to get results. So I think buy-in is going to come easier to the internal promote. And so let's take them separately. For the internal promote, I think the thing I've learned is your day of highest credibility was your last day of a seller, and it's all downhill from there. Right? There will come a day where no one remembers when you sold and you're that old guy thinking back to when you used to hit the phones. And so don't think that credibility sticks around forever, and don't think that you need to keep working at it to deliver it. I think the risks in the buy-in category for that internal promote is they're going to be managing their peers. It's really awkward to go from friend and peer and colleague sitting side by side to management and management responsibilities, right? Where you have to really change the nature of that relationship. Depending on employment law, you're assuming responsibility and liability in some of these cases. And so I think the risks there come from understanding how to change the relationship, understanding that maybe taking people out for drinks every day after work isn't the best way to maintain that buy-in, or maybe letting your friends slide on not kind of holding them accountable to the same standard. Mm-hmm. Those are, that builds friends, but not buy-in, and ultimately erodes your authority as a leader. And I think I see new managers always struggling with those trade-offs. For the external manager, it's an all-out fight. Some of them have to get on the phones. Some of them have to do all that extra work to prove that they can sell. You know, some of them have to provide value in other ways. Maybe it's helping with time management. Maybe it's helping scrub leads for a rep so that they can show that they're valuable and kind of slowly earn that trust inch by inch before they start maybe applying new techniques that the manager is bringing from somewhere else. Mm-hmm.
Can you think of a time where you've taken over an internal team as like an internal hire and had to sort of build that buy-in?
Oh, I mean, every single new leadership role I step into, you start from scratch. Really, if they haven't worked side by side with you for years, you're in that position. The guidance that I got when I stepped into those roles that I think served me well was Rome wasn't built in a day. And you're not just going to come in and change everything and fix everything overnight. So, you know, take the time to learn the new business before you start trying to change anything. I can't tell you how many leaders I've either witnessed at other organizations or some brought into ours that want to fix everything and just assume everything is the same way that it was at their previous business. Mm-hmm. So take the time to get to understand the business. Take the time to get to understand the people. Right? You're going to be working long hours side by side with every one of these people every day. And so you have to have a EQ relationship that goes alongside that work relationship. And then I think the part that people forget, especially if they are at the top of the leadership equation, is you have to add value, right? If I'm not able to solve problems for my team members, if I'm not able to come up with better solutions, if I'm not able to take things off their plate that they don't want to do to just ultimately make them feel better and feel like I'm useful, they're not going to trust me with bigger leaps of faith. They're not going to trust me when I suggest we restructure things or trust me when I say we should try the pitch this way. So I think it starts with building trust in small pieces. And then eventually once they've seen some wins based on your guidance, then you can go for some of the bigger things. Hopefully that's not too high level.
No, it's good. And so, and that's coming in as an external person, right?
Yeah, I think certainly as an external person, but there are equations in which it happens internally where you're moving from the outside outbound to the inbound team, or the outside sales team to the inside sales team. And so I think there's no cost to approaching a new leadership opportunity, assuming that you know nothing, starting from scratch, learning the business, getting to know the people. There's no cost. You're not in that much of a rush. The cost is very high if you go too quickly and you never get that buy-in, and then you're kind of a lame duck leader that just doesn't have the buy-in from anyone, and you can't get anything done because people don't trust that you even understand the basics of the business.
Love it. It's one of those things that it's hard to sort of picture until you've actually been there and you're sitting there thinking like, I'm not a dumb guy. I've done this before. What am I doing wrong? But you've jumped way up the pyramid way too quickly, and you haven't started at that foundational level of building that buy-in, building that trust.
And I think that's the thing that motivates me to do a podcast like that. We have team members on our team today that are sellers and want to be managers, and they express that interest. And, you know, we're having conversations about these traits, and everything's so intangible. It becomes very fuzzy very quickly after being an individual contributor. And it is soft skills that are really hard to put your finger on. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I challenge myself to do. I think structuring this and having this conversation with you pushes me to get better at it. But I need to be able to put it in words they can understand. I need to be able to create scenarios that they can see, maybe even before they've become leaders. Because you're right, until you've done it, it almost doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so how are we going to build the training bench, the next generation of leaders, without getting better at doing that?
Totally. It's about making mistakes.
Yes.
Communication. Talk to me about some mistakes that you've made here.
So, you know, I think at the very, very, very simplest, I talk a little bit about kind of setting your minimum bar and then working your way up from there. I think the minimum bar is really explaining things in simple ways, especially if you're a senior sales leader and you've spent a lot of time thinking about the business from a big picture. You can't just show up and speak that way to your team members if they haven't had that background and had that level of exposure. And so I think you always need to be able to break those complex problems down in simple terms to make sure everyone understands you. I think the next level of that is just, you know, tailoring it to your audience. The way you're going to speak to sales managers on the team or sales directors is going to be different than sales frontline sellers. And it has nothing to do with IQ and intelligence, right? It has everything to do with what their day-to-day is focused on. Unfortunately, individual contributors, as much as they would love to get involved in the strategy, they've got a full day of cold calling. And so they're not exposed to it. And so just make sure you're taking the time to break things down and make it simple. When it comes to managers, the mistakes I see a lot is managers were promoted into sales leadership from being a top seller. A top seller often doesn't have to think all that much about selling, right? Which makes them pretty bad at explaining it to someone who is new. And so there is this gap between top seller that became a manager and brand new employee, that communication is the only thing that's going to bridge it. And so putting yourselves in their shoes, being able to explain things simply, I've seen has been a real challenge and a real struggle for brand new managers, and something we spend a lot of time making sure they understand before they ever get into that role.
Can you tell me about a time with a personal story? Maybe you've, maybe screwed this up a little bit.
Oh man.
If you had to pick one.
I mean, I can't think of an example off the top of my head.
It's because you're so experienced at it that it's just hard to.
No. There are too many.
Yeah.
I think you know, these things are amplified by being in a startup, and you know, I think a lot of times I have an idea and I share. So another part of communication, I think this is maybe a part that I didn't explain, understanding that you're gonna have to repeat yourself a lot. And so I think where I get myself into trouble is I'll be having a conversation about something new that we want to start doing, or I'll have a really, really deep conversation with one person, and then I'll forget that I didn't tell the other two directors on the team. And then when they don't understand later on, I get frustrated. And so it may just be as simple as kind of how information flows through an organization when it gets up to 60 or 70 people. Get comfortable repeating yourself. And it, yet again, it's, you're just, I always feel like I have to do that three times as much as I'm comfortable with, because there are more people. And because just because I told one person, they didn't go out and spread the news to everyone else. So I've botched that a ton of times where I just told one person and then kind of was like, hey guys, how come you're not aware of this? And they just look at me with blank stares.
One of my mentors here in Vancouver, Adam Laurent from FIMI, his advice to me when I first sort of stepped into, I mean, my title was always CEO, but when I felt like I was really actually leading people, one of the things he said that really stuck with me was that by the time you are sick and tired of saying, you know, this one thing, that's just like, you've said this so much, you're sick of it. You don't want to talk about it anymore. That is just the time that people are starting to pay attention to what you're saying.
Yeah. I learned this from someone I consider a mentor and a peer, Christy Schaffler. We used to work together at Living Social. And I think she's a VP of sales of a company down in Florida these days. And what one of the talents that I think she had in spades was the ability to repeat the same message in 40 different ways. And what I think happened is each different variation of it stuck with someone different. And she was smart enough and quick enough and an effective enough communicator that instead of saying the same thing 50 times in a row, she was always finding a different way to say it. And it connected with different people. And ultimately it was probably more fun for her. I watched her execute on this communication trait masterfully. And I'm still trying to get there myself.
It's the opportunity to be a little bit creative in the role.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Speaking of creativity, we're going to talk about motivation. Can you do your best Alec Baldwin for me?
No, I can't. In fact, I resent the Alec Baldwin references when they come to sales, because I think the always be closing thing is actually damaging to
the let alone the fact that that speech is probably not, you know, is a little bit dated in terms of, yeah, the content.
A lot of just, problems with it. And yeah. Honestly, it's probably guided many sales managers in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So tell us about the right direction to take motivation. Where do you start?
Same thing, like entry level here, starting place is really acknowledging that people are motivated by different things. It was an eye-opening experience for me when I was at Living Social and I realized that not all salespeople are money motivated.
Blew my mind.
Yes.
What do you mean you don't want more money? Huh?
Right. And, I don't know if that's a generational thing. I don't know if that's a cultural thing, because I built sales teams in a couple different countries, in France and in the UK and Brazil. And, I can't put my finger on it, but I've seen it across all these different places. And I think you have people that are motivated by mastery. There are people that are motivated by recognition. There are people that are money motivated. There are people that are kind of lifestyle motivated by being able to have a quality of life balance. Mm-hmm. And if you wave that money in front of the wrong person, it's not going to connect. And it's not a one size fits all approach. I think, and table stakes is just understanding that it's different. Another kind of rule that I learned, and I stole it from somewhere. I think it was, I can't even remember where I stole it from, but I call it the motivation triangle. And somebody wrote that motivation starts with job clarity, moves into recognition, and then success. And so the way it works is, if a new team member joins your team and they, for the life of them, can't figure out what they're supposed to do in their job, they will never be motivated, right?
Yeah.
Just having it defined, but then being able to define it down to the specifics. In this outbound account executive role, we expect you to get 50% of your opportunities from your SDR, 50% need to be self-generated. The self-generated portion of that, we expect for you to get through a cold call cadence. It looks like this, it's this many touches. Here are some of the emails other people have had success with. That's the kind of granular level of role clarity that almost anyone can come into and be like, all right, I got it, I can do this. So I think it starts with job clarity and then it moves into recognition. What I've seen a lot in sales teams is that close that everyone's, so addicted to and everyone's searching. Sometimes it doesn't come that quickly when you start in a new in a new org. And so you need to bridge the gap to that first taste of success. And so recognition, I think you've probably heard the term, recognize small wins, but recognize them executing on the process as they're building up their pipeline, right? Every one of those steps, if it's in the right direction, that's a celebration. And it helps bridge the gap in the fear between all the work that they're doing and the payoff, which sometimes that payoff on a long sales cycle can be soul crushing. And so, you know, that recognition, I think, is the middle piece. And then when they actually taste success, that's what closes the loop, gets them really motivated. I think it ties back to buy-in, right? If you have explained what the job is, supported them and coached them all the way through till they get that win, it clicks, right? They click and they buy into you a little bit. You get that win a couple of times, they're going to trust you more and more. And eventually you're going to kind of build up the leadership everyone writes about in books, you know, the leadership that salespeople will run through walls for you. It's evasive, but I think that's how you get there, is by coaching so many people to that success. And we're addicted, you know, we're salespeople, we're addicted to that success.
Mm-hmm. It's such a great point. I think just based on our last sort of communication point, I think we need to say it again, is that it's really hard to recognize the sort of middle steps before you get to that final, hey, I've closed a deal, unless you have that role, unless you start with that role clarity.
And I would say, I think a lot of companies out there don't even know what the middle steps are, right? It's such a common mistake to focus exclusively on results or outcomes and on none of the inputs. And what could possibly be a more confusing message to new people joining the team than close more deals, go get more results, but we're not going to tell you where they're coming from or how to get them or the steps to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, I see that as my job. I see that as our leader's job to crack the code, to break down the sale into those steps, understand the relationship between the inputs and the outputs, because that's where your coaching and development is going to come from, is teaching that playbook that you know works, as opposed to what I think happens is either coaching to the scoreboard or coaching to what worked for me as a sales manager, right? And that, I think a lot of that, I think that's what happens. And frankly, that's not just the sales manager's problem, right? If the leadership didn't invest in reverse engineering the sales process and figuring out what works, the sales manager really can only coach what worked for them. And that's only going to resonate with a subset of the team. Not everybody on the team is going to have the same methods of building rapport, personalities, et cetera.
I feel like I should be taking notes here. I'm glad this is recorded.
Hope I'm not getting too worked up. I get a little passionate about this.
I love it. Love it, Evan. So now that you've got sort of the team's bought in, they understand that, like, they understand what their goals are. They know what the role is. They're motivated. Next step is development, right? You're bringing in new team members. You need to get them from, you know, point A to point B, which would be, you know, whether it's, I don't know what the development plan like is in your organization, whether they're progressing from, you know, SDR to AE to senior A or whatnot. But how do you take somebody from, you know, fresh to, you know, ready for that next role?
Yep. So I think, you know, the order of these traits matters at this point, because you're not going to be able to develop someone until you've achieved that buy-in, you're able to effectively communicate, and you can kind of get them motivated enough to try new things. Then when you're starting to think about development, you know, a new person has everything to learn, and you can't start by just throwing all of those things at them at once. You know, that's the throw six tennis balls and see how many they catch type of situation. And so I think the key to this, for me, at least what I've learned in my career, and we've seen some, you know, obviously I haven't cracked the code. It doesn't work everywhere. It's not perfect all the time, but is really asking yourself, what is the most basic skill that this person is lacking that's preventing them from getting to the next level of success? And so if maybe a way to do this is, say, if you have your basic skills on the left-hand side and your advanced skills on the right-hand side, what I see is a lot of managers, because they are such good sellers, really focus on all those advanced skills. So new person shows up 3 weeks in, the manager's like, you can't close. Well, that is true, right? But it's not particularly useful. And so I think it is factually a correct statement. But what they need to be asking is the question, why can't they close? They're not listening. Why aren't they listening? They're not confident enough in the way that they're speaking about the product. And so they're so nervous about what they're saying, that they can't pay attention and listen to what the other person is saying. Why are they nervous? They haven't role played enough, right? And you got to work your way from the advanced skills all the way up to kind of the most basic skill that might be missing. And then that's kind of where your starting point is. And so I think you can do that through observing them, through headsetting, through just watching, whether it's remotely or just kind of shadowing if you're an outside sales seller. You can also do it by looking at the numbers, right? A lot of times you can work your way back up that pipeline and find the first spot in the pipeline where they're just converting less than everyone else. That's a good hint that there might be an issue to start with. So I think that's really the diagnosis portion of coaching. And I think a lot of people just jump to conclusions really fast. I know it's wrong. I'm going to teach you this new power close, and your close rate is going to go through the ceiling. Mm-hmm. Once you get the diagnosis, I think the next step is really about building a coaching plan. And it's always best when done together. If you can ask questions and get that team member to diagnose the same problem on their own, they're going to be bought into working on fixing it. If you're just like, hey, you really suck at this thing, that is not a super motivating way to get their sign up or buy-in to work on this problem. So self-diagnosis, see if they can get there and identify the problem on their own, and then say, great, we're in this together. Let's figure it out. And I think you can prescribe a portion of the coaching plan to them. It might be more headsetting. It might be shadowing other reps. It might be, you know, writing out their own script in their words, whatever it might be. And then there's a portion of that coaching plan that's owned by the manager. Right, a lot of managers like to say, like, this is on you, right? Go get better at this. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we've all had deadbeat teachers in college or in high school, and we've had those engaged and proactive teachers that get involved in the learning. And I think that's what works best. What is your portion of that responsibility as the leader? Are you committing to go scrub 5 extra leads and review those leads at the end of the day with them to help them understand why they're getting the wrong leads? Are you going to role play with them? Are you going to do, hot potato with the group in a group setting just to help people come up with objections faster? There's kind of an active learning component to this.
How frequently do you play hot potato?
It's been a while. It's been a while, but I think back when I focused purely on SDRs, when new people join and they have not spent a lot of time client facing, everyone's got nerves to deal with. And I think being put on the spot in a time-sensitive situation in a group setting, it doesn't quite approximate being on a cold call or being in an in-person meeting for the first time, but there's that kind of edge and sensitivity to it. So you can help desensitize people to that by taking the pitch, splitting it up amongst the team members. Each person says a line and passes it on to the next person. It's a good learning mechanism. It doesn't work for all types of learners, but it's a good one for a certain set of people.
No, like real hot potato, or do you use some?
No, just the scripting line. Just the scripting. You could do that without objections, right? You can have someone throw an objection and then point. Uh-huh. Right? No one knows who's going to be coming next. And so, you know, that recreates that selling environment off the phone. I think a lot of sellers, it takes a certain amount of at-bats to learn how to do something. And if prospecting is hard and they don't have the top of their funnel, they're just never going to get the at-bats to get good at those skills. And so, you know, a big part of this development piece is how managers give them at-bats, real-world situations that approximate a sale, and let them practice and try things out before they kind of botch it in the real world.
Totally. So now that we've got the buy-in, we're communicating effectively, team's motivated, we're working on custom development plans for each of our individual reps.
Oh, I missed that. That's a huge, huge point. I think development when done at kind of master level is an individualized curriculum per person. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I haven't always been able to achieve that, but I've seen sales leaders and sales managers who can, and that is just incredible to see.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what you're saying. Like if you're sitting down individually with the reps and walking them through and having them come up, it's not just you as the leader that's coming up with this plan. It's actually each of the individual reps telling you, you know, mm-hmm. and you're guiding them like along the way, you're sort of leading them there.
We love acronyms. One of the ones that some of the team members here use is a JOT, just one thing. And that helps them remember that you should be only really assigning them just one thing to work on in this particular coaching session, or even, you know, it could be just one thing that lasts a month. Mm-hmm. a focused coaching plan on just one thing, and you stick to it until they improve and show that lift in the conversion rate, and then you celebrate the hell out of it.
Why just one thing? Why not, you know, this guy's got, I'm looking at this new hire and he's got four or five things that he's doing, but all of them are compounding on top of each other. Yeah. And it's like, it's breaking down. We've got to fix all of them right now.
It's the six tennis balls thing again. He's only going to catch one, or she's only going to catch one. And I think you're potentially setting them up to fail by saying, try to do everything all at once. Mm. Often there is something that's not obvious, that's even more basic than what you see on the surface, that's really causing the problem. And if you can dig in and you can go find that and help an improvement there, you'll see some steps. The other thing is, if the skill is a big skill, you got to remember, you might not have the buy-in to tackle that skill, right? The rep may not, the seller may not be super self-aware that their pitch isn't as smooth as they think it is. And you may not have the credibility to say, hey, this part of your pitch that you think is really good, or this way that you explain the product that you think is the best on the floor, it's not really that good. And so you may have to work on a couple of small wins before you go after those bigger fish.
Gotcha. So now that we've got this custom development plan, next step is holding them accountable to their numbers. So where does this start? Where does it end? I'm sure it's more than, hey, you didn't hit your numbers last month, or you're not making enough dials. Like, where do you start here?
It could be accountability for the coaching plan, right? I think it starts with creating an environment of accountability. Listen, we're all here to work. We're all here professional. We're all here to be professionals. Frankly, you know, we're all here because we're top of our game and we're really passionate about building this particular business. And the expectations are we're going to do our end of the work. So I think having that set up front as part of the culture and the expectations is why we write these down as our management traits. So I can say, you know, I tell managers, these are the traits I'm looking for in my interview. These are the traits I'm going to give you feedback on when you're on our team, and I'm going to give you coaching against. These are the traits that are going to help you progress in your career. When you excel in one of these categories, that's going to be the thing that helps us promote you. And so I think it's the same thing with the team member. When you're a manager, setting expectations in terms of what you expect on the team, doing that up front, that goes back to that communication piece, right? A lot of managers love to try to hold people accountable for something that they never asked anybody to do when they're in a rush. And so I think the items higher on the list, buy-in, communication, motivation, development, you need to have done that work as a manager first before you ever earn that right. And if you have put in that work, right, and you as the manager have put in that 115% when you notice that the team member might not be, you've earned the right to address it. And it will be well received, right, because they know you've worked your tail off to help them out and to develop them. And so I think whether it is a conversation about you missed your number, or whether it's a conversation about we talked about working on this skill, I put in all this extra time as your manager helping you on this skill, and now we're talking 2 weeks later and you didn't do any of your portion of what we agreed to, you know, that starts to sting a little bit more once you've done all that other work up front. For me as a manager though, I think the hardest part about accountability is everyone's scared. Right? Holding people accountable is like closing. Everyone gets nervous when they start asking for the business, right? Everyone gets really nervous when they have to give honest, direct feedback that's negative. It's a terrifying experience. You never learned about it in school. And so I think that's why it was important to make it on the list and to talk about, you know, constructive and respectful ways to do it. Because there's a lot of, you know, Alec Baldwin screaming and yelling, I don't think is the path for that one.
Yeah. Just too many examples. I think I've been, it's so easy to fall back on that sort of inner coach that's yelling at the referee or whatnot. That's just like, no, you see something that's wrong and you're just trying to point it out. But how do you go gracefully about this? I mean, you've built the respect, you know, if you've followed all the steps ahead of time. So what does that look like?
So I think doing the work and starting early and often is important because it sets the stage, and people who get used to receiving feedback, right? And there's a thin line, like accountability can be, you know, feedback. It can be specific coaching, pointing out areas where things aren't working. But people get used to it over time once they realize it's safe. Right? I think a salesperson who thinks that an accountability conversation or coaching feedback that might be negative is followed by termination is never going to be open-minded and listening. And so I think it probably starts most through the coaching, saying like, listen, this is where we can talk about what's working and what's not, and creating a safe place. The other thing is the, you know, taking emotion and blame out of the equation, right? Mm-hmm. And learning to deliver and have those communications in neutral terms that aren't personally attacking people. Those are difficult soft skills to get. Not something that I learned from my first sales manager, not something that I learned in school. And the best sales leaders that I've seen have those conversations, have the toughest ones. They do it themselves, and they do it in a respectful and constructive way. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool to see done. And I didn't really understand it or learn that skill till I watched people do it well.
It's really challenging to sort of separate the person from the way they do things. And recognize that it's sort of, it's not you that I'm not mad, but it's not you that's doing or that's wrong here. It's just the process that you're following. It's that little algorithm in your noggin that we need to just tweak a tiny little bit.
Yeah. I think back to the inputs versus outputs, it's going to be more constructive if it's like, we talked about these inputs and you didn't do them, rather than I told you to get $100,000 more in revenue last month and you didn't do it. And I didn't do anything either. Right. You're going to lose people real quickly there. Mm-hmm. It's tough. Now I think when it's done right, the first time where you give constructive, accurate, valid, honest feedback and you set the stage right, and the person's like, oh yeah, I didn't do that. Oh, I'm glad you called that to my attention. Like, I'm going to change my behavior. When a sales manager sees that it led to change, right, the whole thing clicks for both the team member and the sales manager. And they're like, oh, this is the way by which I can kind of help get people to what I need them doing. And it doesn't have to hurt and it doesn't have to sting for it to happen. So I think everyone's nervous the first time, but once you get it right and you realize the person was actually appreciative of this fact and it led to a positive outcome, I think then you're now in an environment where that becomes the norm. I think, I can't remember who, one of these hedge fund managers just published a book on radical candor or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. I don't know how extreme they're taking it, and I haven't had a chance to read it through, but I think this concept is picking up in a lot of places. It's just, you know, the accountability is where it shows up the most, but it can be, you know, all kinds of direct feedback.
You know, we're not holding their feet to the fire, but you know, we've got the development plan. We're working on them, and we're holding them accountable to actually acting on it. Next step is sort of structure and process. So, can you give me some examples of like, what are some good examples of structure and process? Maybe what are some bad examples of process that you've seen that hasn't worked so well?
Yeah, so I think you know, it can be anywhere, but one example of structure and process is a sales leader that I used to work with that had built their own format and structure for one-on-ones. And they had a system by which they emailed the recap of the one-on-ones. That way it was explicitly clear what was agreed upon and who was going to do what. And they used that structure and process to help provide the foundation for accountability later if there was any questions as to what was supposed to happen. So I think that's an example of planning ahead, putting process in place. That wasn't obviously accountability wasn't the only benefit. They had a section in this format where the team member was bringing their parts of the one-on-one, certain numbers, certain questions, specific accounts. And I think they got more value out of their one-on-ones than 99% of the managers I see out there who just kind of walk in and say, yo, what's up? What's on your mind? So I think that would be one example. I think, you know, a cadence, a follow-up process, rules of thumb around kicking deals out of your pipeline if no movement has happened are all examples of process that I've either seen managers come up with or, you know, senior managers develop with those teams and roll it out. At the very simplest level, it's, if you're going to help 8 people at once, it does help if there's some overlap and there's some structure to their approach. And so that might be as simple as the sales process, frankly. right? And having common stage definitions where everyone on the team is using, well, I strongly believe everyone on the entire sales team should be sharing those, but at the very basic level, you know, using the same definitions for your team members.
Mm-hmm.
I think the opposite is just winging it, right? Salespeople love to do things on the fly.
No.
Right? And honestly, you know, we overlook this part of the conversation. This is kind of an obvious one I should have said earlier, is being a sales manager almost has no overlap with the skills of being a salesperson, right? And being able to wing it and improvise in a sales situation is a huge skill. But being overly reliant that on that in a management situation can get you into trouble. And so I think that's where the structure and process approach come into play.
I smile. I interview a lot of people now, and I smile when I'm interviewing somebody new, a fresh college grad or, you know, experienced salesperson. I'm like, what are your future career goals? Where do you want to be? And almost everybody says, I want to be a manager. It's like, well, do you really enjoy sales? Oh yeah, I love sales. It's like, well, why would you want to manage salespeople? Like it's a different job. You either want to manage people or you want to be excellent at sales. And it's okay to want to do one or the other, but being excellent at sales doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be the sales manager one day, nor should you. I know so many salespeople that make way more than their managers.
Absolutely. And I personally went into management because I got more out of the rush of watching someone else succeed and do the job well than I did from closing business myself. Mm-hmm. I was just so terrified that I wasn't going to get the next one. I never really stopped to enjoy the close itself. But, you know, I liked the coaching and developing aspect. I liked working closely with people, like seeing them kind of wrap their head around new tasks, as obviously people can tell I'm a geek for this stuff. So sharing it is a big part of who I am. And I think that's why the leadership track really drew me into it. Even if, like you just said, I had no idea what it was getting into it.
Absolutely. It was something that was just sort of, I got by default because, you know.
Accidental sales manager.
Yeah.
If you're in that boat, read the book. It's a little bit all over the place, but there are just really good nuggets spread throughout.
Perfect. So last piece we want to talk about, and I know we've been going on for an hour, but this has been an amazingly detailed conversation. I think I'm going to go back and take so many notes.
Hopefully we weren't too theoretical. I know the show's about being tactical.
You know, every now and then, I think we got to change it up just a little bit just to keep people on their toes so it's not exactly the same thing over and over and over again. But talk to me about the analytics. And I'm sure, you know, most people have their basic pipeline analytics, but what are the important ones to you? And maybe what are some, if there's some stories of times where it hasn't worked out so well for you?
Okay. So I think, you know, this analytics piece is really about the future of sales. The way things are going with technology, we are now in a position to be able to measure so much more of what we do. And I think that shifts sales from being an art, a dark art, a magic that no one really understood why it worked and why it didn't, and attributed, you know, incredible powers to the people that could make it happen. We have the opportunity to use numbers to break it down, to understand it, to be able to inform what we teach to our people, and to be able to reproduce it and scale it, right? That is ultimately what we're talking about, scaling. That's where we started the equation. Mm-hmm. You will not scale your business unless you use numbers to break down why it's working and then teach those skills that are working consistently to everybody. Some specific examples. You know, I think we'll start with the classic misunderstanding. I can't tell you how many teams focus aggressively on dials and talk time, yet they have no idea what they mean, right? And so they're recommending dials and talk time. I've seen a lot of teams where the people that have the highest of both of those numbers have the lowest results.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's asking any questions. It's an important number. You have to have this at a minimum. And so the question is, why aren't they related, right? And that's because you've only taken a look at the quantitative aspect, and you haven't really broken it down further and said, well, what's the difference between a call that converts and one that doesn't? Are there metrics that are missing in this equation? So let's think about connect rates, with prospects, and you've got gatekeepers, you've got influencers and doctors. If you're not tracking that, 100 cold calls that go to gatekeepers will never convert as much as 100 cold calls that go straight to the decision maker. And so that would be an example where you can kind of think you're metrics driven and think you're being analytical because you ask about these numbers every single day. I think analytics help you get that layer deeper, not only understanding, you know, what is happening, but why it's happening and the difference between what's working and what's not. A great example, I had a friend that was running a sales team where they loved to pitch on the fly, right? Back to the improv seller that likes to do everything and kind of wing it. And what they realized by looking at the numbers is that the team members pitching on the fly were converting less than the team members that were setting a meeting, right? So that they took the time to prepare, they were able to do pre-meeting research. And actually they looked into it a little bit more and realized that team members that had higher tenure actually converted at the same. So the lesson that you take away from this is new team members who haven't been selling very long or haven't done enough pitches or presentations probably shouldn't just be pitching on the fly and winging it, and that there's a cost to doing it that way. Those are some examples of interesting learnings. The last case I'd make for analytics is I can't tell you how many times I've been wrong and the numbers told a different story, right? And I was digging and I was digging and it didn't add up, and I finally kind of get to the bottom of these numbers and I realized that we'd been thinking about it just completely the wrong way, right? And we could have, imagine if we had told sellers to go do this thing that the numbers are now telling me it doesn't work. I feel a lot of responsibility to make sure that what I'm teaching is what the managers are teaching is the stuff that works, and numbers are the foundation for all of that.
Hmm. I mean, like you said, it all comes back to scaling, and the analytics are sort of what feed back into the structure, and it feeds back into, you know, having that accountability, and it ties directly into being able to communicate clearly what the role is and what these are the things that this is the playbook you need to run. This is these are the activities that you need to hit. Right. You can't really have a balanced, you can't really have a balanced pyramid unless you're sort of looking at the analytics at the top and sort of using that to tie back into all the other stages.
Well, think of that sales management trap that we thought about before. You know, if you're a company that's at 10 million in ARR, let's say you're at 1 million in ARR, and your sales managers and your sales leaders, rather than thinking big picture and thinking in a repeatable, scalable way, they're always thinking about where they can get that next $100,000 deal. And, you know, going out and making a deal appear, if there aren't 100 more or 1,000 more behind it, doesn't really mean anything on the way to a 20 million or 50 million or 100 million ARR company. And so at some point, once you've gotten to that, you know, there's product market fit, that there's something here, you really have to shift that mindset from chasing revenue to chasing kind of repeatable, scalable, predictable sources of revenue, right? And it is sometimes that salesperson's mentality of hunting and going right after the prize, you're missing the bigger opportunity and you're not thinking in that scalable way.
Totally. Great place to end it here. Evan, any final thoughts? Like we've gone through so much from, you know, all the different systems and all the traits of what great sales management looks like. Any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
No, I'd love to see you guys continue to bring more sales leaders on the show, and that we kind of open up the black box and share as much as we can, because these are difficult challenges to be facing on your own, to be facing as the kind of first sales manager at a brand new startup. Mm-hmm. Share, right? It's not a zero sum game, and I appreciate what you guys are doing for the community.
Thanks, man. You're totally right. There aren't that many schools that offer, you know, sales courses, let alone sales management courses. And it's one of the only professions out there where you have to sort of figure it out on the fly. And the best sort of the top performers get promoted. Like imagine if at a hospital, the best surgeon got promoted to running the hospital. Like obviously that doesn't make sense. And I don't know, maybe it does because they know the ins and outs, but it's two totally different skill sets that you need for two different jobs. But it feels like everybody that goes into sales, the majority of people feel like that's the natural next step, when in reality, it's not, it's a totally different job.
Yeah, let's knowledge will help make the switch and the transition for people less painful.
Beautiful. Well, Evan, thanks again. This has been very informative. I feel like I learned so much, and I hope the audience got the same. So thank you again for coming on the show.
Thanks again, Colin. Appreciate it.